Ways and Means Committee, the Subcommittee on Public Safety for Monday, May 9th, 2005. This is a hearing on House Bill 5042, the Oregon Judicial Department. And I'm going to invite up Chief Carson, and looks like Kingsley Click and Nancy Miller will be a part of this beginning discussion. Ms. Lamont, would you like to begin?
Yes, Madam Chair. I did hand out an ELICO overview of the Judicial Department Phase 2, including budget notes, audit findings, and I handed it out. The subcommittee can pursue that at their leisure, and I thought we should just go ahead and start with the presentation from the Judicial Department.
Very good. Chief, would you like to introduce the panel?
Yes, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, it's my opportunity to introduce the State Court Administrator, Kingsley Click, and the Deputy State Court Administrator for Court Programs.
Close enough, Chief.
Close enough. Okay. Nancy Miller. And I'm Wally Carson. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. My role here today is as the Administrative Head of the Judicial Department. I want to thank the Chair and Ms. Lamont and the committee for providing this opportunity to revisit our budget. I do appreciate the opportunity. Our remarks today are based in large measure on our vision and our mission, and they appear on page one of the handout material. You will recall that the vision was the outgrowth of a program started in March of 1992 to look at what the court system would be doing at 2020, which was then some 28 years in the future. We completed our report, and because time is moving very fast, particularly for those of us that are elderly, we decided that we would revisit it, and under the chair guidance of Judge Pamela Abernathy, we revisited the vision, and also we have smoothed out or updated our mission, and that kind of forms our template for visiting how we are conducting business in the court system. Our country is a constitutional republic, as we all know, and all three branches all agree that our country is based upon the fundamental rule of law. All branches, I think, believe that or are aware of that, and we are particularly in our third branch, the small branch, and from that we garner the list or our mantra, so to speak, courts are the backbone of democracy, in the sense that we couldn't operate without all three branches, but our focus is primarily on the rule of law, as it is with the other two branches in part. And I thought that was punctuated last week when Representative Brad Avakian and his staff put on a program many of you attended, and I thank you for that, in Room 50 relating to jury appreciation. The centerpiece of what we do is the jury itself. And I was prepared to talk to, quote, de Tocqueville, but I'll go on because that's not appropriate at the moment. It's always appropriate. But we had an analysis, I think it was 16, 18 years ago by then President of the Senate, John Kitzhaber, who remarked on the three important jobs of government. One is child and family, two is public safety, and three is economic vitality. These are my words, but they're basically what he came up with when he and then Speaker Campbell appeared, I think it was during a joint committee meeting on the focus of government. As a result of Governor Roberts' challenge to all the departments and agencies, we were asked to prioritize during her early administration what it is we do, and then State Court Administrator Bill Linden and I put together a list of everything we do and where it's categorized, and we use that to prioritize our work that we do. And now that has been, polished up a little bit, and it appears on page two, I believe.
Two little eyes,
yes. Strong court fills strong communities. We're into graphics. And it's now characterized as vulnerable people ensure public safety and sustain the economy. And quite frankly, we can divide everything we do into those categories. And they appear as the three pillars on our graphic. We don't mean to be boastful. It's a fact that everything comes through our doors. A lot comes through your doors, and an awful lot goes through the executive doors, but if you're, whether it's civil law or criminal law, it comes through our doors. And we understand our role. We do not make the law. That's a little misleading in the fact that we do interpret the law or try to determine what the legislature intended, and in a true sense, we are making law by our interpretation, but we do not make policy, or we try not to make policy. We are a responsive branch of government, not a proactive or active branch of government. We hear cases that are brought to us, not one that we concoct in our own mind. In fact, we have an opinion that came out 6 months or so ago. Again, reiterate what has been true of the court for a number of years, is that we do not write advisory opinions. So we have to have a case of controversy or two litigants. That has to be a real program. And that has been a long-standing position for our court, and our opinion reconfirmed that not too long ago. We try to do our work in the most effective and efficient way possible, meet the needs of all Oregonians, to make sure it's done fairly and impartially. With that, I will be quiet for a while and turn to Ms. Miller, who's going to take you through the next part.
Thank you very much, Chief. And as always, it's good to see you this afternoon.
Good to see you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Devlin, for the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations in the Judicial Department. I am going to talk a little bit about the next graphic in your packet, which really is a simple way to outline the major budget drivers for the Judicial Department. It's this lovely little picture of the trucks and cars. And the question that was asked in the budget instructions by the co-chairs was around what's happened in the past 10 years in your quote-unquote agency, and we don't normally use that word, but as you can see, our highway has really grown over the past 10 years. Before 1995, we were driven by arrests and prosecutions, court filings, ballot measures, constitutional mandates, your basic work of the courts, and we talk about that in terms of the old days and the run them through the doors case processing kind of things that we did that were effective, but not as, I think, effective as the new methods that we're using, which we'll talk about as we get down a little further. From 1995 to 2003, you can see that a few more trucks hit the road. Ballot measure 11 passed. We started to see significant demographic changes in Oregon that were driving the court system. The passage of the Adoption and Safe Families Act by Congress in 1997, implemented in Oregon in 1999, changed the entire face of the dependency court process and how we handle child abuse and neglect cases, making those cases much more complex and bringing numerous new parties to the table. Again, you see our ballot measures and our constitutional mandates, and then the ever-not-so-popular roadblock that we faced in 2001 and 2003 with the budget reductions. And the question that was posed by the co-chairs in the instructions asked us to really focus on the last couple of years. So as soon as I do a little bit more on this graphic, the chief will talk to you some more about that. From 2003 forward, you can see that the highway gets more and more crowded, driven now by the big rig, methamphetamine, and the associated drug and property crimes that go with it. And we've had some very interesting discussions throughout the session about drug courts and methamphetamine as the driver for the public safety system in general. One of the things that struck me, and if you look on the back of your page, I had a conversation with one member of the body who said, you know, Nancy, I really want to do something about funding drug courts, but with all due respect, I don't want to do anything about the rest of your problems, because we've been placed in the very unenviable position of saying, without filling the $24.6 million budget gap that we had, it'll be difficult for us to expand drug courts. So I sat with him and I said, well, you know, you've sat through many hearings about methamphetamine and how it affects the system, but for us, what you're saying here is you want to look at the top of this and say, I want to deal with the drug crime. When in fact, what falls from that drug crime, as you can see, associated property crimes, often a child abuse and neglect case, a delinquency case, a restraining order, a divorce, an eviction, a mental commitment, a civil bankruptcy. This is not out of the realm of reality at all. This is not presented to you just for effect, but it is presented to you to give you an idea of how that budget driver alone affects all three pillars of our courthouse graphic that the chief talked to you about before. In 2003 forward, again, you see the demographic changes and the case complexity continuing to have an impact on our system, and the presence of self-represented litigants in the court system has become another major budget driver for us. And actually, the creation of our facilitation programs go back a little further than 2003, but the issues around access to justice become more and more complex for us as time goes on. The next page, the major budget drivers and environmental factors after the graphic, are really taken from the skit that we did earlier in the session. And if you recall, we did a skit about the dependency process and one about the criminal process. And as you can see here, the list of things that drive the courts is long and it's complex. As the chief said, we don't go out seeking business. We are a responsive branch of government. What comes through our doors, we handle. And as we will explain for the next 2 days, we hope that we are handling them in ever more efficient and effective manners. So the chief will talk, if you don't have any questions about this, the chief will talk next about the last 2 years.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, I want to be very clear at the outset that notwithstanding the good support that we got from the public safety subcommittee 2 years ago at this time and continuing through the interim, the 2 years and also the 2 years before that, we fell on hard times in the 2001-03 that has left lasting scars and also, in my view, a depressed budget from which we're trying to recover, and with your help we will do so. No other aspect of government received the whack we did. Over a 30% budget reduction in the last 4 months, and court closures, layoffs, reductions of work hours. Many courts across the country are receiving or receive similar budget reductions, but I became the poster child for and asked to write on how Oregon is handling its closed courts and a variety of other things, layoffs and furloughs and delay of certain cases. This biennium, 2003-05, we're in a much better position, although we got jolted by the fact that ballot measure 30 on January 30 that was set to gain us some additional revenue was defeated at the polls, and so we have been struggling to stay up with our workload. The Budget Reduction Advisory Committee that we formed during the five special sessions of the 01-03 is in existence. It's met once, pretty well preliminary, at least, determined that we will have, again, a uniform statewide plan with some benefit, extra benefit for the very smallest courts. Try to minimize the impact on the highest priority of cases, and you recall those drums or silos, or we have, through a meeting with the trial court administrators and the presiding judges over time, developed our list of the 16 things we do and ranking them in priority. Without sufficient funds to meet our maintenance budget, the only weapon we have or the only solution we have is to do things slower. We'll try to give priority to those items that have been identified to be at the top and the greatest interest in the Oregon public, and those things at the bottom, we'll get to them as soon as we have staff to do just that. We're trying to maintain the highest possible level of public access and service that is feasible in the fact that with over 90% of our budget being general fund, any adjustment in that downward is critical, and I think it's about 92% of our budget is personnel, so any adjustment downward means we have less people to man the counters or conduct jury trials or whatever it may be. We deeply appreciate and acknowledge the work of the co-chairs after the governor reduced our budget and others by 9% in submitting his balanced budget in December to the legislature. The co-chairs, about a month ago, 3 weeks ago, penciled back in $19 million. The original cut by the governor was $24.6 million from the $274.4 that we have listed in our graphics. They penciled back in. And I use the word penciled advisedly. I've been around here long enough to know that if you're writing in ink at this time of the year, then you may be disappointed. So he put they agreed, and both their budgets had the same amount of $19 million. That leaves us about 5.4, where we think we need to be. Would we wither on the vine if we don't make that? Probably not. I'll say it's not. But that money generally goes where we do to maintain it, and if we don't have the money to maintain it, there'll be a consequence of some sort, which will probably, again, be delay. In these 2 days, we'll be discussing the recommended budget. We appreciate this opportunity, and at any point, you recall the mental image I left is that we're still kind of a flyby at this point. I think that was Nancy's. But obviously, the committee, and our laissez fiscal analysts have, just at your call, if you want me to shove the stick further down so that we can get a closer look at any part of this, just do so. Or if I'm prattling on like maybe I am now, just pull the stick back and I'll go up to a higher altitude and that will move us on faster. We appreciate this opportunity to have this conversation, and quite frankly, I will say we've appreciated the pleasant way we've been dealt with throughout this, well, in the past, but particularly this year, through the chair and other members of the committee, it's really been a good experience to be here, and we thank you for your civility and interest, and it's just very nice.
Before you go on, I believe that Senator Devlin has a question or comment.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator.
No problem.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chief Justice, looking at both of those budget proposals, both from the House co-chair and the Senate co-chair, it was a little bit unclear whether or not they presume that within that $19 is a reinstitution of the surcharge on court filing fees. What is your understanding of their understanding is what I'm...
I'll give you, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin. It is my understanding that they are aware of another bill that the surcharge is set to expire June 30 of this year, as you know. And my understanding is that part, because it's now instead of $6 million for biennium, it's because the understanding and the amendments have been offered to the bill, and I think it was Representative Hansen's bill as the vehicle for this, was that the 30% surcharge was going to be continued only for 18 months, meaning it will expire before the legislature comes back in 2007, and that will add about $5 million. And my understanding is that part of that 19 is the assumption of the bill passing and the $5 million being restored. I'm getting some nods, so I...
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's my understanding also, that budget assumes passage of some sort of restoration of the surcharge.
Let me also note, so that you all know what's happening, the House is still in session, and I understand they have one more bill, but there's also a caucus taking place, so we will continue on here.
Well, I feel somewhat comfortable about it because, as the two senators here know, I've met individually with all the members of the legislative body, and we've had an overview that is shorter than this, lucky for them. And I'm comfortable that particularly this committee understands our dilemma, and I've talked too long from this matter. Our recommended budget will provide us the resources to continue the work that we have been doing, and I believe, although biased, it's an excellent, and will continue to ensure adequate access to our courts, and that we will spend the public money well and effectively and efficiently and provide innovative case resolution. Family courts and drug courts and a variety of other things we do to make the process work better. That is, in fact, that will keep the courthouse doors open. And with that, I'll...
Thank you very much, Chief Carson. Ms. Miller, are you ready to go next?
Madam Chair, I think I might be finished. I think it's up to Ms. Cliff.
Finish for a few minutes. And then Nancy, Susan.
That's my cue, right? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you both.
We'll see you again.
Very much.
Madam Chair, I was just going to mention our Phase 2 presentation covers all the materials that the Legislative Fiscal Ways and Means memo requested, and we have all the detail in here, and then we just tried to arrange so it would be easier for the subcommittee members to follow us this time compared to Phase 1, just to have our materials arranged in the order that we were going to present them.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that.
Or we're going to try. So we're on page 5, and it's Article C, the OJD budget summary, which we did get into in Phase 1, and is basically just a few minutes refresher for context before we get into more detail of the budget, which Susan Klosterman will present. So on page 5, it's just the context for the overall Judicial Department budget. We're about 2.44% of the general fund. As the Chief mentioned, we're 90% general funded, and we'll list our other sources in a minute. The little graph on the left is just the operations part, so that's minus mandated payments, and compared that to where we were a little over 10 years ago, and we were about 2.87% of the general fund then. So our percentage overall is down, but for you, it's the context of looking at how we administer the money we have, but we have not grown in that same proportion. On pages 6 and 7 are the graphs that you've seen before that really touch base on the governor's recommended budget. The governor's number was just a number applied against an overall figure, and it amounted to 9% reduction without any specified cuts in any areas. So for us, and why the graphic shows a compressed case processing system, is without a removal of obligations, statutory requirements, or other things, really what significantly less money means to us in the 36 counties where our courts are and appellate administration is that you have to prioritize your work, and what you don't have sufficient resources for kind of drops to the bottom, and you get to it, you don't not do it, but it takes longer. And the highest priorities for the court system for the last 3 biennium have been public commitments, public safety, and to child and family welfare matters, and our case priorities have reflected that through both the good times and the bad times with our budget. Page 7 was just the backside of that graphic, which illustrated not only what damages when you see a compressed case processing system, what does that mean? It means justice is delayed, services are degraded, programs that have been proven to be affected are dismantled, and our workforce is depleted. On the right side, as this committee has had in its principles and paid quite a bit of attention to, is the overall balance of the public safety system. Courts, in our perspective, not just because we work in them, but we think we're the key funnel in that system, though we count on what comes in and what's there on the other side, but the court enforcement action is really what makes the public safety system effective from a legal and rule of law point of view, and then certainly how effective we are on either end of that with the other services in the public safety sector mean what happens overall to our society. On pages 6 No, I'm sorry, 8. Eyeglasses on. Our source of our funds are pretty simple. We have 90% general funded, and then we have other funds, which are primarily grants and some of federal pass-through money that comes through DHS or other entities, and that's approximately 7.4%. And then we get 1.13% of federal funds, and that's primarily grants. And then we do have some 0.43% of some unlimited other funds that are customer fees and money that comes in through some OGIN online services primarily. In our program areas, we're also pretty straightforward as well. Trial court operations is the bulk of the system, as you'd imagine, because we have circuit courts in all 36 counties, 70% of our budget. Central support, which is mainly costs that are related to government service charges, assessments, third-party collection agencies, fees, things that are on behalf of the judicial department as an agency entity, are approximately 7% of our costs. Administration and statewide programs, which include Citizen Review Board and the Certified Interpreter Services, are 14%. Appellate courts comprise about 6% of our costs, and mandated payments, which are jurors and ADA, can I use that acronym? costs are about 4% of our overall budget costs. Page 10 is the high-level summary dollar chart that you've seen before, which looks at our O3 dollars originally, and then our O3 O5 dollars after the Measure 30 passed, which was a reduction of $13 million, against the Chief Justice's maintenance level, which is our central budget level in the legislative budget terms, and then the governor's recommended budget. Most of our increases from our legislatively approved budget are what I call non-improvement items. They address specific costs, such as restoring our ballot Measure 30 reductions. They have the backfill for the 30% surcharge that's designed to go away at the end of June unless there's a continuation of some part of it. Our pension obligation assessment share is approximately $9 million. And then we have, which is common in the state government budgeting instructions, we have one merit increase, and we have a cost for our flexible benefits, such as the cost of health insurance. And then we have adjustments. So that explains at a high level what our overall change is from our over 3.0305. So this is our numbers without any of the policy option packages or any other enhancements to the chief's overall budget. Susan Klosterman was going to walk through the budget detail that starts on page 11 with section D.
Madam Chair and Representative Devlin, I'll start on page 11, and as you look at that, you probably wonder how much deeper we could go. but we had prepared this table. I'm Susan Klosterman, Deputy State Quartermaster for Business Operations, and I just wanted to put this in the presentation materials today. It's something we had prepared at the request of Representative Hanna during our Phase 1 budget hearings to provide a crosswalk to the information we've been providing and some information that had been included in Robin Lamont's LFO analysis of the governor's budget. What it is more detail. The summary at the top is the same information as was included in page 10, but the additional detail provides the funding sources and the biennial history for the four budget programs that are included in the Chief Justice's recommended budget. So we have the appellate and tax court operations, the administration and central support, the trial court operations, and the mandated payments. Those are also the same four programs included in the pie charts Kingsley referenced earlier. Across the top, we have the 0305 legislatively adopted budget, the legislatively approved, which included the Measure 30, $13 million reduction. And then column 3 has the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget, which is pretty much what we've been focusing on to date and throughout phase 1, primarily because of the underfunding, the unspecified reductions that were included in the governor's budget. Today, though, we will, as promised, talk about the policy option packages that are included in the Chief Justice's recommended budget. So the policy option packages, along with the Chief Justice's maintenance level, are what we refer to as the Chief Justice's recommended budget, and that's the final column on this spreadsheet, on this table. Before we start talking more about the policy option packages, and also we will talk about the essential packages that are included in the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget, we have included on page 12 a couple of responses to information requests that were included in the budget instructions. And the first is about our other funds balances. And we've said that our Chief Justice's maintenance level budget is 90% general funded. The remaining 10% is primarily other funds, and a list of those accounts is included on page 12. Most of them are small dollar amounts. The largest is the Judicial Department Collections account. The monies that flow through there are related to our third-party private collection agency and Department of Revenue collection costs, and also the positions within the Judicial Department that are funded with the revenues collected by the department. The Judicial Operating Account was a new account established just this last biennium. That's where the filing fee surcharge goes. And if there's any interest in the others, I can talk about those more. But there's additional detail in Exhibit 9 also. Number 3 on page 12 is the vacancy report, and included in Exhibit 10 is the detail included in the last vacancy report requested from Legislative Fiscal, and that response was prepared in December. Of those 82 positions listed on the report, and I won't read this, but you can see the reasons why they were vacant. Some were being held vacant at that time still to achieve savings related to the Measure 30 cuts. Some were in the middle of the hiring process, and similar kinds of reasons for vacancies exist today. And there's more detail there, as I said, in Exhibit 10. Madam Chair, if there are no questions, I'll proceed with page 13 and describe only the essential budget packages that are unique to the Judicial Department, and these are packages that are included in the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget. Kingsley did mention the first one there, which is common to all, the $9 million for the pension bond obligation, and I mention that because it is the largest essential package that we have. But those that are unique to OJD, the Judicial Department, are a phase-in of some one-time. This is package number 021 on page 13. We had a phase-in or add-back of some one-time reductions that were made in the last legislative session. One was a $1 million reduction for technology purchases that were taken due to some purchases made late in the biennium that were seen to be kind of cost avoidance for the upcoming 03-05 biennium. In addition, some unfunded costs for new judge and staffing positions. So those are added back to fully fund those positions and the computer technology ongoing needs. We've phased out or removed the costs for grants that are expiring. That's package 022, and we have a mandated caseload, just a small FTE increase for interpreter caseload increases for the non-English speaking population. That's in the package number 040. And then the last package is related to the filing fee surcharge. Since under current law it was to expire on June 30, 05, that Chief Justice's maintenance level budget assumes that general fund will replace those filing fee surcharges in 0507.
Did you skip over 030, or did I just...
I skipped over it, Madam Chair, because it's the standard inflation that applied to all of state government. But, yes, we do have that also in the Chief Justice's maintenance level budget. And with that, Madam Chair, I believe Kingsley is going to walk through briefly the policy option packages.
Very good. Madam Chair, on page 14 lists the OJD policy option packages, which are included in the Chief Justice's recommended budget, the blue volume. We've included brief descriptions of them, and I was just going to highlight what they are, and then after I'm done with leave of the chair, we were going to have a couple of the actual packages talked about in a little more detail that relate to what I would call continuation of the Chief Justice's maintenance level of services, even though they're in addition to his maintenance level budget numbers now. The first one is current workload issues, which is what we call a regular growth or staffing equilibrium-based package. It looks at where the caseloads have shifted and what the needs are. And the information technology piece will be dealt with when we deal with the IT discussion tomorrow, along with their policy option packages. And core programs and services are going to discuss theirs with Nancy Miller when she presents some in a few minutes. The appellate courts still have a need for an appellate staff attorney. Chief Judge Brewer is here if you have more questions on that, but we've been working with him to continue on a temporary position into a permanent position, and right now are looking at potentially moving around some in-house permanent financing to accomplish that, but that is a need of his. Package 102 and 103, Nancy Miller is going to address when she comes up here, but the family drug court positions are ones that go away with grants and for which we are seeking now permanent position authority and general fund to continue those programs. 104, our facilities package has to do with every biennium. There are adjustments that are made to the facilities that are the responsibility of the county, but we're responsible for the in-house infrastructure of them, the furnishings, in addition to not only sound systems, but computers and furniture. Right now, we want to mention them. Usually we come in and make a special request when they're due and we don't have another internal resource we've been able to identify to address them. In Hermiston, there was a recent fire that destroyed the current court facilities. There is another one, though, the county's been building, and some of our court facility issues are being able to be addressed through the risk management replacement of from the fire. So package 108, Nancy's going to speak to on the court improvement projects, as well as package 106. 107, 108, and 109 deal with information technology, and we're going to address those tomorrow when we talk about what happened with the strategic planning initiative that we had this biennium, and what are the recommendations, and what do we need to carry out some of those charges in this upcoming biennium. Package 111 was a small one for furniture and equipment, and I've verified that we have been able to take care of that within our internal means this biennium since this was put together, which is usually some of the larger courts sharing some of their savings and some of our program savings to address trial courts that have no savings to put to their needs. Package 112 I'm going to address in just 1 minute at the end because there's been some updates on it, is our other funds issues, which are usually our continuation of grants that will go through the 0507 biennium. Package 113, we touched on briefly in phase one, which is our cost of living and health benefit increase package for the Judicial Department. And usually in the past, the governor's 2005-07 state budget has a provision for all state employees in that. And in the past, we've had some percentage of those funds distributed to the Judicial Department. I believe Senator Devlin asked in phase one, would this happen for this biennium? And I believe the exec branch comment back was that for 0507 in the emergency fund reservation would be some funds for judicial for this purpose. And I don't know if that's changed, but that was at least where things were a couple months ago. Package 201, interpreter staffing, Nancy is going to talk about with the court programs discussion. Package 301 is the new judgeship package, which is tied to legislation, which is now down in Ways and Means. House Bill 2278 came down from House Judiciary with a recommendation of four judgeships in that bill. So when that's, we thought that would maybe be discussed in more detail when that bill, and if that bill is scheduled for hearing in Ways and Means. Package 302 is similarly situated. It's, well, it's not in Ways and Means at this time, but there are proposals that would change the judicial retirement plan to perhaps improve the number of Plan B judges eligible for service as pro tems. That bill requires, or that package requires legislation. It's in, it's been assigned to another committee, but they are working on getting that down to Ways and Means. We did have an accrual, report from PERS on it, and at least for 0507, they did not anticipate that the major features of it would increase the employer rate, though, for 0709. That's always visited again in context with the state's overall rates. Put my page backwards. Package.
Thank you. Where would the four judgeships be located?
It's in package. Let me just mention that package. Package 301. And that would need to go with House Bill 2278. 2278 came from House Judiciary, is now, was referred down to Ways and Means in, I believe, March, the end of March. There is recommendations in it for four judgeships. Clatsop. Umatilla. Umatilla Morrow, now you've got me doing it.
So the four again are
Jackson. Well, it starts out, it's Clackamas in the first priority, and then Jackson County, then Umatilla Morrow, which is one judicial district, two counties, and then Clatsop. Out of the 11 that the Willis Committee, which is the new joint committee, recommended, and they followed their first four priorities out of the 11 and put those in that bill. So the costs associated with that would be different than appear in the package, because the package was for all, and the package also included what I call stopgap pro tem funds for the recommendations of the committee. So if the judgeship came on board January 1st of 07, which is what the bills provide, so they would be elected terms, there would still be funding for the 18 months prior to that for pro tem support for those judicial districts, as well as other districts that were recommended for judgeships. Package 303 is a judicial compensation package that also requires legislation in order to change salaries of judges because they are provided for by statute. In our description there on page 23, we talk about how the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, and Circuit Court ranks nationally compared to other judge salary rankings throughout the nation. They've remained in the bottom quadrant, and there is a proposal that would seek to raise them to the median, but that is not yet down in Ways and Means. But that would be the time at which that one would be discussed in more detail if the Legislative Assembly entertains that. Package 304 was a juror compensation bill that had to do with some legislation that originally the department was interested in introducing to increase the rates that are paid to jurors. However, with the December governor's budget and the forecast that had come out right before that, we ended up not introducing it for this session. We did work on a kind of a backup plan that could be introduced that would cost about $1 million still to implement. So we've held this pending further interest, so we don't have that right now in our packages to go forward. On page 24, we have two updates to the packages that were in the Chief Justice recommended budget. One is a reduction, which is with the IT information that will be provided tomorrow. Since our strategic plan and recommendations didn't come out till the end of March, kind of the time frames for what could be accomplished in 05-07 are more conservative, and as will be discussed tomorrow when we get to what the recommendations are, we're now asking for under $2 million for the policy package that relates to IT improvements. Policy Package 112 is our other funds package, which is adjusted for all the grants and changes to date that have come out since the Chief Justice's published budget, and the detail for that appears on page 25. And basically, we received certain other juvenile drug court and adult drug court and child enforcement monies, or we have the potential for the upcoming biennium, and we've adjusted our numbers for that and can go in more detail with legislative fiscal staff when they're ready to work on that piece. So with that, Chair Gordley, if there aren't questions at this point, I would like to turn the podium back over to Nancy Miller, who's brought Judge Daryl Larson and David Factor from the Lane County Courts to highlight some of our policy option packages that relate to our performance measures. Thank you.
Do that next.
Madam Chair, again, for the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations, and I'm really here to answer any filling questions from our much more effusive presenters, Dave Factor, who is the Child Court Administrator in Lane County, and Judge Daryl Larson, who is one of our champion drug court judges, and they are going to run through the policy packages that Kingsley told you we would provide a little more detail on.
Very good. Thank you both for being here this afternoon. We appreciate your presence. Thank you,
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin. Thanks for the opportunity to talk a little bit about the policy packages and the Chief's recommended budget. My name is David Factor. I'm the Trial Court Administrator in Lane County Circuit Court. With me is Judge Daryl Larson, one of the leading figures in Oregon's drug courts and founder of our 10-year-old drug court in Lane County. We spend a lot of time in this discussion so far through phase one and now talking about how to get back to the maintenance level budget. But there's many other things that we do to fulfill the vision of the OJD as a branch of government and to complete the work that's assigned and directed to us by the legislature and the work we want to do ourselves to meet the needs of our constituents in the communities in which we serve. There are four packages that we're asked to talk about today, kind of on, again, on a fairly higher level, not grinding through the details of the budget piece. And those are the interpreter services package, which was identified as number 201, the application contribution program, identified as package number 103, the court improvement package, identified as number 105, and there's actually three pieces within that that we'll talk about briefly. One is dependency mediation. One is a project in Lane County, which we refer to as the Defendant Offender Management Center, which is an outgrowth of what has been our pretrial services program there. And then a very small piece related to child care in the courthouse for people who are using the facilities. And then the final package is number 102, which is our family drug court package. With all due respect to the chief and to Chief Judge Brewer, the trial courts is really where it all happens here in the state. Everything, as the chief noted, everything comes through our doors, from the business of the community, the welfare of children and families in our community, and public safety. And these packages, which we've elected to highlight today, really deal with all of those pieces. Every year, there's over 600,000 new cases filed in circuit courts in Oregon, and only about less than 1% of those are referred up to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. So the work is really where the rubber hits the road is in the trial courts and in the communities where we are serving the people who need us most. We recognize that there's been incredible pressure on the budget here, and we were given instructions as putting together this budget, going into this cycle, to really narrow our requests for additional policy packages or for monies outside of kind of the maintenance level budget, and I think we've done that. And what's included in the chief's recommended budget are what have been recognized as highly compelling packages. And we made a determined effort to make sure that these packages are aligned with the vision of the judicial branch as articulated by the chief and to the performance measures which were adopted and which we're all working towards, which were presented to you in phase one of this presentation. Each trial court and division presented their policy packages if they have them, and they're required to link them to at least one of three categories, and most of them are related to more than one of those, and that was the regular growth, performance measure based, to assist us in reaching the measure where we were falling short and we need some help to get there, or future focused related to innovative programs. Package number 201, I'll turn to the details of that in a little bit, is related to interpreter services. This is a performance-based package related to access for all. It's also part of our regular growth in that the number of people who come to our doors now who need assistance with foreign language interpreter services in order to take advantage of the court has grown tremendously. This is part of mandated payments. As the fund that it comes from. Really, as much as it helps the people who come to us, it helps the courts to do its job and allows us to provide access to all to the court functions and protections that we provide. Primarily, the use of interpreters has been limited to Spanish-speaking people, but all kinds of languages. Last week in our court, we had the need for Korean interpreters. A couple of days before that, we had need for interpreters who spoke Marshallese.
Don't forget Farsi.
Farsi has actually been, we've been struggling to find enough interpreters on any given day Farsi. The package here provides additional staff interpreter provisions in order to expand access in courts and geographically throughout the state. In addition to that, there are positions in the package that allow for would allow us to do a better job, more efficient, effective job of scheduling and coordinating the need for interpreters and using those staff interpreters in the places where we need them. And part of that, part of the issue there is identifying early enough in the case the need for interpreter services, preferably at a first appearance. In a criminal case, that's often easy. In a civil case, it's not always so easy. You have to rely on the parties to let you know there's a need. And so we finding new ways to get that information early in the case that we can flag it and have the interpreter there when we need them. So, because we can't proceed when the parties show up and they have that need for an interpreter, we can't go forward if we don't have that person there. If we just find out on the day of trial, we have to postpone the case and we use up that resource that we could better use some other time.
Doctor, how often does that happen, postponement of a case, or have you been able to find interpreters in those cases where you needed them and been able to deliver them where they have been needed?
In our court in Lane County, we have three contract interpreters that provide services. They're all Spanish-speaking interpreters. We have no interpreters that we use on a regular basis that speak other languages. We have, for the Spanish speakers, we have kind of at least one of those interpreters we have on kind of a rotation who's there every day, primarily because we run arraignment courts for criminal cases every day, and we can guess that there will be a need for that service. So when they're in the building, they help us out in other places if we need them. There are still times when the lawyers or the parties will show up for what we call ready call, which is when the cases get assigned out for trial, and they have not either let us know or made arrangements with us for an interpreter to be present, and we postpone those matters. Or the parties show up without a lawyer, unrepresented, and that's the first opportunity we have to find out that they need an interpreter, or that the court will need an interpreter in order to proceed with the matter.
And Madam Chair, if I might add, it's interesting that you asked that question. We just had a conversation about this last week. We are getting, as we talked about in Phase 1, more and more requests for very difficult to find languages. And in my experience directing the interpreter program for the last year, those are the cases where it is more likely that we will have to continue. And we've actually had a very difficult discussion about how do you balance not continuing a case and spending an exorbitant amount of money to bring someone in. And I'll give an example that happened in Washington County. We brought in an interpreter from an island in the Pacific, and now it's not coming to me. And it was a language where I think just over 2,000 people in the world spoke the language. So we flew this person in so that the case could proceed on time. Had we been able to wait a week, we probably could have gotten an interpreter from the state of Washington. But that's the struggle that we have all the time. We don't want to deny access, and we don't want to spend exorbitant amounts of the public's money. Not in exorbitant is way an exaggeration. We don't want to spend a large amount of the public's money. But how you balance that is always a challenge. You know, do you go or do you wait a week? It's an ongoing conversation that we have in the interpreter program all the time.
Mm-hmm. And so what was the decision point around waiting a week or not? What tipped the balance?
Madam Chair, the judge wanted to go.
Okay.
Thank you. I don't have a lot other detail in this package. There are four interpreter positions in this package. There's two interpreter coordinator positions in the package, and those are people that would be staff in the court. Some of them might work on a regional basis, depending on the volume of the courts in that region, to help us identify early on as possible and to get the services to the court when it's necessary, so that we don't have to continue and we don't have to postpone cases. And again, like all of the packages, I think, that are in this presentation, or in fact that are in the budget recommendation, they don't do it all. They move us closer to our goal. This is not the extent of the need for interpreter services in the OJD, but it's a step in that direction. The application contribution program is package number 103. And this package is one that the legislature asked the courts to, in the 2003 session, directed the judicial branch to complete implementation by Nancy for a date as soon as possible. I'm guessing this was the language, but I'm certain there was an 05 date. I think we were supposed to report back to this legislative assembly about the progress towards implementation statewide. And this is really an expansion of our indigent defense verification program. The application in the title of the ACP program reflects an application fee that's assessed at the time someone appears at their first appearance and they're making a request for court-appointed counsel. The courts can make a decision to assess that on that at that time. The contribution piece is an opportunity to assess the cost for court-appointed attorneys up front without having to wait until the conclusion of the case. If the party does pay during the course of the while the case is pending, then it's offset with the court-appointed attorney's fee as it's assessed at the end of the case. If not, it's all reflected in the judgment that's attached to the case. There is a need for additional staff in the trial courts to operate this program. This package asks for 7 positions throughout various courts in order to enhance the work of that project.
And Madam Chair, 3 of those positions are existing positions, so they are to make permanent those. And the other 3.75 are focused on courts where the juvenile facility is separate in a different location, like Clackamas, for example. We have tried to implement the application contribution program in juvenile cases this biennium, and we've really hit a difficult spot in those places where the juvenile court is in a separate facility.
There's no other questions about that particular package. I don't know that I have anything really more to add to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
The court improvement project, package number 105, was originally in the budget document in 2 different places, but now it's in the presentation today on page 18. And there's really 3 different components in that package. One is really something that I know is near and dear to Ms. Miller's heart, is the dependency mediation project, which you'll see in the admin central support part. And the other two actually are pieces that come out of Lane County in trial court operations. And they are performance measure-based packages. The 2 in Lane County are the Defendant Offender Management Center, part of our pretrial services project in conjunction with the sheriff and parole and probation. And the others are child care and the courthouse project. Child care and the court project is similar to what you've heard about the court cares project out of Multnomah County. We have been working with a wide variety of community partners in developing a needs assessment and a plan for implementing a safe place in the courthouse for children to be whose parents are taking advantage of programs in the court, whether it be restraining orders, whether they're there for trial themselves. But generally speaking, it's not a good place for children to be either in trial or when one parent is testifying against another parent in a custody matter or about a restraining order. So trying to find a place where the children who need to be there can be in a safe environment is really a good thing. This package asks for $60,000 to expand a project that we have now, which is currently half a day a week on Monday mornings. We have a motorhome that pulls up in front of the courthouse that's run by our local relief nursery, and that's the day that that's the busiest day for us for restraining order hearings, domestic abuse cases.
And this is Lane County?
This is in Lane County. Our relief nursery operates that primarily through a Volunteers of America grant. And while we are working to identify a permanent location and space for a child care facility and local funding to operate that on an ongoing basis, we would like to expand that project to 5 days a week, a half a day each day. And that's the cost that it would be for the relief nursery to have their staff bring that mobile child care facility and park it in the front of our courthouse. The dependency mediation part of that package is continues pilot programs in six counties where they currently are, and intends to expand the availability of the dependency mediation project statewide. Currently, there's federal juvenile court improvement project money that supports programs in Baker, Clatsop, Marion, Union, Wallowa, and Umatilla, which provides an opportunity to mediate these dependency cases before they go to trial. It saves money, saves judicial resources, and generally ends up with a better solution for the families and the parties that are involved in these cases. Avoids the confrontation and the win-lose kind of situation in these matters that you often get to in litigation. Certainly pursues the better interests of the child in a way that really satisfies, it's much more satisfactory to the people that are involved, including the state and child welfare workers, as well as the families who are involved. This package asks for four positions, but I noted Nancy knows the details of this better than I do. 1.14 FTE. So maybe she can describe how that gets, how you create that in four positions. I'm sure it has something to do with the way they're rolled out.
Madam Chair, I'm sure it does too, but I'd have to go back and dig through all the detail to tell you that. Just a couple of more things about the mediation package. Our Juvenile Court Improvement Project federal funds come to us at the grand total of about $185,000 a year to fund juvenile court improvement projects across the state. It's been an amazing bang for the buck use of money. It's one of the few federal funding streams that come directly to the courts. When we started the dependency mediation program, we intended it to be a pilot started with the Juvenile Court Improvement Project Fund so that we could evaluate it, see how it worked. We had it evaluated by a national expert out of Colorado, and the results were extremely positive. We had planned to ask to have this project or this dependency mediation program rolled out statewide the session before last, 2001 and 3, and obviously because of all the budget difficulties, we weren't able to do that. We have sustained it with the Juvenile Court Improvement Project funds, but we are at the point now where we were required by the federal government this last year to do a new assessment of our juvenile court operations and a new set of recommendations, kind of the refreshing the recommendations we did in 1997. I can provide you a copy of that assessment. It's about that thick and has some very innovative and exciting recommendations for how we might continue to improve our juvenile court processes. So to use that limited amount of money to sustain a pilot is just impossible for us, and this program will go away if it cannot be sustained by general fund.
The third piece of that court improvement project package, number 105, is the what we've come to refer to in Lane County as the Defendant Offender Management Center. It's an outgrowth of what had been our pretrial services project in Lane County, which has interviews all people who are lodged in the jail pre-trial, screens them for risk, for failure to appear, dangerousness, and recidivism, and releases them when possible on conditional release agreements, which are try to guarantee their return. Over the last several years, over the last 2 years in particular, we've worked closely with our sheriff and the corrections division to develop and implement a common risk tool. So the sheriff, who's under a federal court order for population for capacity in the jail, and the court have developed a tool that we use that's the same tool. It didn't used to be that way. The sheriff would release people when they reached capacity based on just a quick assessment of criminal history and the pending charge, and would release the person without a release agreement, or would release a sentenced offender without a connection with the with their parole and probation officer and make that connection to the next phase of their sentence, similarly with pretrial people. So we now are using a common tool. We've blended staff. The sheriff has placed three deputies in our release assistance office. The parole and probation office is going to place two officers in that office as well. We've developed a common risk tool. We're using that. We've gone to a 24/7 operation, the goal is to every time the jail is always at capacity. So the goal is that when one new body comes in, one new body is going out, and so they can be done virtually real time, rather than waiting for a once or a twice a day release of 30, 40 people at a time. And the release is not just out into nothing. It's either with conditions or to an alternative program that's available for sentenced offenders or that's available through the community corrections office. This is a validated tool on failure to appear, reduces our failure to appear rate. Really, since we've implemented, to tell you the results on dangerousness and recidivism, but anything was better than what we had before, when people being released with nothing based on nothing other than the jail was at capacity. It's an evidence-based, certainly an evidence-based process. It's a much more objective tool than was used before, and makes much more rational use of the resource that we have to make sure that the most dangerous people stay in jail beds and the least dangerous people are the first ones to be let out the door. Is it the best situation? No, we wish we had capacity to keep people who would otherwise not be released from custody, but we don't have really that luxury. And we don't have the programs in other places to place them either.
And you're calling this process or approach, it's called what?
Well, the name of the or of the center is the Defendant Defender Management Center, and we had offender because it's dealing with both pretrial defendants, people accused of crime who have not yet been convicted, and people who are sentenced as well. So in phase two of this phase one of the project deals with the pretrial release component. The second phase deals with assessing people for their sentenced offenders for their needs and trying to make a connection in a structured sentence for when the person gets placed in the jail. The needs assessment will then govern how they move from a jail capacity to either a forced work camp or a community correction center or a road crew or out to electronic monitoring or to their parole and probation and their and whatever treatment and restitution components they have with their sentence. It's really doing a much better job of linking all the players in the criminal justice system to manage that offender once they're sentenced and moving through the system in order to move them up and down based on their activity in the community.
And Madam Chair, if I could just take 1 minute to bring Representative Wisnett and Representative Hanna up to date on just kind of the overall philosophy of today. We were very excited to have the conversation for the first time about the Chief Justice's recommended budget. We've been so busy and so focused on trying to crawl back to our maintenance level that we, and the Chief said before you came that he very much appreciated the support of this committee and the co-chairs at successfully penciling in the $19 million piece of that whole. But today we were really taking the opportunity to talk about some of the innovative and evidence-based programs that are included in our policy packages, just because we haven't had that chat before.
And my name is David Factor. I'm the trial court administrator in Lane County Circuit Court. We haven't been talking only about Lane County projects, but this happens to be one that I've been involved in for quite some time. And this, the request in this package is really quite a small request. Is there greater need? Of course, but the request is really for one additional clerical staff person plus a small amount of money so that we can complete the programming of the integrated computer system that we're building with the county to integrate the information that we collect on these folks that will populate the forms that are going to release these folks and be maintained in our local area information record system. And so that, I think there's a $50,000 request for programming and a request for a single clerical staff person, which will then give us one clerical staff person on each of the three shifts 24/7. This will be our graveyard person who we don't yet have. Part of this project is funded through community corrections dollars from our county. Part of it's funded by the sheriff. Part of it's funded by the court. And so we're just trying to fill out the rest of that project. In large part, I'd say, you know, all the discussions that you've had in this building and will continue to have the Department of Corrections budget about Senate Bill 1145, project like this really fulfills a lot of the promise of 1145 in managing offenders in the community and trying to do a better job at them and keeping them close to the community and where the resources are that can best serve them. It does a better job of managing their resources efficiently, bridges the gaps in supervision, and really will also help us at the community level in the county to identify the gaps in resources that we have. We can do needs assessments on people and risk assessments on people, and we know what programs would be best used to manage those folks in the community. We may not have enough of those, and so this will let us target that resource to what our population is, which may be different than what the population is in another community. So with that, I'll stop rambling on, and I will introduce Judge Darrell Larson, who's going to talk about the family and drug court package and an issue that's very near and dear to his heart.
Thank you very much, Mr. Factor, and welcome, Judge Larson.
As I mentioned, my name is Darrell Larson. I'm a circuit judge in Lane County, and I've been down there for, well, since 71, practicing either in the prosecutor's office or the bench. In thinking about how to approach this, I decided that my part of this is a fairly narrow focus, and I think that probably the best place to start really is with the 2003 legislative direction concerning evidence-based practices. When you start looking around for what are the evidence-based practices that are really being done out there and instituted on the street at the community level, there are not too many around. And it's hard to determine what is and isn't evidence-based practices, and there's a lot going on about that I needn't stress here today. But I think the direction from the court's point of view, from a single trial judge's point of view, and for those of my colleagues who we've talked a lot about these issues, I think it is the right direction. And it's the right direction because it squeezes the tax dollar and gets the most out of it, the public, and it also is in the right direction because it directly relates to public safety and public health. And both of those are crucial things that must come out of the court process, at least on the criminal side of our docket and the family court side of our docket and juvenile court side of our docket as well. If they don't, then the money wasn't spent very well, and we haven't really moved the processing of that case very far down the road. The evidence-based practices legislation, I think, also does push the system statewide to do things that are really going to get good results in terms of the tax dollar spent and also in terms of the human effectiveness terms, whether it be from the individual's point of view or from the public's point of view. Courts have been and really are integral in that process. As the Chief and Nancy mentioned earlier, really, we don't start things, but we take care of things when they come through our door. And really, most society problems, in a lot of ways, come to our doors. And it should be something more, from my point of view, than just simply processing a case fairly and effectively. It should be actually getting what the public is ultimately paying for on the criminal or juvenile justice side of our docket, which is some measure of increased public safety. And drug courts and integrated family courts, and I think to a large extent family facilitator programs to deal with indigent self-represented people, really have a tendency to help that process dramatically. We now have quite a bit of experience with drug courts, and the terminology is changing, and I want to warn you about that, because you may hear people talking about problem-solving courts or treatment courts or drug courts. Really, those are all kind of the same critter. It's a methodology of approaching problems, oftentimes caused by drugs and alcohol, that lie at the core of whatever the directed problem is, that need to be dealt with effectively as well as efficiently in terms of the court, just the justice process. You also would like to have a good public outcome from that case processing. A lot of money is spent on that through a lot of different systems. And the court, through the drug court model, and I'll use drug court just interchangeably with all those other names, is a wonderful process, because it really does tend to bring together the various parts of the public's resources into one coordinated vertical fashion to try to get the judge who's at the head of that process trying to get a good result and is charged with the result of that process to have a lot of cooperation from a lot of different entities that are out there that the public is paying for that are not being as effectively and efficiently used as could be if there was some consistent direction and responsibility and supervision. And supervision is the key, I think, to any problem-solving court process, whether it be a drug court, a DUI court, a family abuse court, whatever. Supervision is the key. And it's supervision not just of the offender, but supervision of the process that the public is spending money on for treatment, for counseling services, for housing, for employment services. All of those things that play a part in getting a good result are not the responsibility of the court. But the court can play a key part in making sure that the process is set up in such a way that we demand responsibility by those people that are doing those things to get a good result with this particular individual. And all too often now, the public is spending money on a lot of different systems, but there's not coordination enough to get the good result that needs to happen. And judges, I guess happily or regrettably, depending on the day of the week, are in a position to try to make that happen. There's been a natural tendency over time, I think longer ago, for the courts to play a very hands-off process, you know, or not be part of the solution, but just to simply process the cases. But if you do this for very long, let me make each of you judge for a day. 1 o'clock in the afternoon, your job is to walk up on the bench and sentence one or more offenders, most of whom are probably drug and alcohol affected, many of whom are probably addicted or at least dependent on some drug or alcohol or both. They have a substantial prior record in many cases. They have all kinds of mental and physical problems. Their health may be gone. Their teeth are no longer there. They don't have a job. There's really no prospect for them. In the condition you find them in, looking down at them, you really see no hope in front of you. And yet you're charged with doing something that's going to give the public a good outcome here. What's that going to be? You can sentence the person just in the traditional system to say, you know, here are the obligations, you're on probation, you get X number of days in jail, and you're going to go to the probation department and be supervised over there. Well, the truth of the matter is the probation department is largely overloaded. They're dealing with, once again, their highest risk individuals. And, you know, these offenders are a dime a dozen, frankly, especially with the methamphetamine epidemic that we've got. So really, if that's what you do in the traditional system, you simply process the case and send the person on their way. They may or may not show up at the probation department. Even if they do, they probably won't get any real supervision. Treatment won't occur even though you ordered it, because the person isn't in a condition to do treatment voluntarily. They can't even remember to go from here to the probation department without forgetting where you told them to go. I mean, literally, their memories are shot. And so in that light, You can see why judges all over the state are now developing drug courts and courts like that, because they want to have a better result for the public. They do not want to have to deal with the same person next week that they just dealt with this week and find out none of the things they even started have occurred. So drug courts are a very practical way to get the public some bang for its buck, and also actually on a human basis to get a better outcome for that individual and for the public at large, because if they're not out there stealing and doing other things that get them in trouble, it's a benefit to all of us. And it also is a cost reduction for all of us. I've handed out a packet. It's actually a PowerPoint presentation that was prepared by Shannon Carey, who was really the chief investigator for NPC research in Lake Oswego, to do a very comprehensive study, time management study of drug courts, both in Oregon in a couple of instances and also in some jurisdictions in California. And you'll note, if you look through the packet of materials, you'll find that the results were, in varying dollars amounts, very good in all of those courts, with one exception. And that one exception is really a dramatic outlier and has a lot to do with the way that the court in that particular county interacted with clients, and doesn't really so much have to do with how the process is set up to do that. It helps to want to have good outcomes and then to do everything in your power to get them. They can be had, and these courts are a large part of doing that. There is another kind of court that we, I think, call by various names, but it's oftentimes called an integrated family court. An integrated family court is there to address and wrap around a family as a package. No matter which individual comes into the court, it might be the juvenile son or daughter that's involved. They may have guardianship problems. There may be a divorce in progress. There may be criminal charges against one or more of the parents in the family. It might be a multiplicity of those. In that instance, the court tries to once again integrate and verticalize the development of that case's processing by one judge taking control and gathering or bundling all the cases and taking charge of that and trying to make sense in a comprehensive, consistent fashion to get a good result for that individual in the particular case and also for the family as a whole. Needless to say, that takes some staff to do that. A judge on their own cannot do that. And so integrated family courts are in need of coordination services, as are drug courts, to be able to handle the multiplicity of reports that are coming into the court and to get it done in a timely way so the judge can have the report the court needs to deal with that individual in the morning every day, takes some coordination and assistance from staff. These positions that are talked about in the particular this point in our presentation are really to deal with those kinds of positions. One thing I think that also has to be separated out a little bit here is that the court has its obligation in terms of the justice system and the processing of a particular case. There may be things in the wider public system that are needed to make those things effective, such as treatment of various kinds or housing or whatever it might be. But that is not really the focus of the court's budget request today. Our focus is really on the coordinator positions for drug courts and integrated family courts and also family law facilitation. It was mentioned here earlier that a lot of people are coming into the courts who really are self-represented, what we refer to as pro se litigants. They oftentimes really don't know how to process their case through the court or how to even get access to the court. Family law facilitators are a very, I think, inexpensive and rational way to approach that, to deal with these large numbers of people that are approaching the courts to get various matters resolved, usually in the family law sector, sometimes other sectors. Domestic violence is one of those areas. To have people who can answer questions, provide the proper forms, and to allow people to make it through the court system in a way that makes sense, that doesn't cause further delay and disruption to the court process and continues to allow the court to be effective and efficient in the conduct of its business.
Judge Larson?
Yes.
May I ask you a question, please, about the slide presentation? On page 6, looking at who participates in drug court. Was the program designed to serve males only?
No. A particular program? These are from various jurisdictions, and different jurisdictions, as one would guess, target different people, and they have different kinds of cases that they've chosen to be the target focus of their drug court.
Okay.
So some could be, but most aren't.
There's a representation here, an incomplete representation of participants in drug court. I see the male representation. I'm just going to... Do you follow my drift?
Yes.
It is a drift. Okay. What about crack cocaine addiction? How does that show up, if at all, in the who participates in drug court? It seems to be heavily meth influenced, heavily heroin influenced.
It really depends on the jurisdiction and the particular time period they're talking about. What's happening, obviously, all over the country is that meth is taking over the territory formerly populated by other drugs.
Looking at Oregon, we have two jurisdictions, Portland and Marion County. Again, I'm just wondering how it is that we wound up with the emphasis on... well, let me ask the question differently. I guess in Portland, I would want to unpack those numbers and see what other drugs of choice are showing up in drug court. That would be one way to approach it. And then in Marion County, I would want to know what are the other drug involvements outside of meth.
Madam Chair, I'd really look at the type of drug with a jaundiced eye. And I can tell you why, because we do a survey the day they enter drug court, and we ask the person, tell me what your drugs of choice are, and we leave some spaces for them to do that. They almost invariably never tell us anything remotely close to the truth about what their particular poison is. It's only after a month or two of treatment that we find out what really is going on with this person, and it usually is dramatically different. And so, you know, if this data is uniformly taken from each jurisdiction at a particular point in the processing of that person, then that might be a little more reliable. But, I mean, when I look at Portland as 29% meth, these are a couple of years old, actually, because that particular study is one of the older ones. The California ones are a little bit newer. It may have changed in that period of time. I think the farther you get out of the big cities, sometimes the more meth is used.
And Madam Chair, our Oregon Drug Court Management System tracks drug of choice. I can look at what the data is showing. I do want to check, as Judge Larson is suggesting, when that data is taken and whether it's updated as the person progresses through the program. But I know one of the things, pardon me, that we track is drug of choice, so I can see if I can get you some data. I'm not sure how NPC collected theirs.
I guess another way of looking at this is to ask which clients coming into the system who are the best candidates for participation in the program. I guess that's another way of looking at it. This data shows predominantly white male meth users, but there has to be some other experience in there too, and it's just not, I'm not seeing it on this particular chart. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's some pretty decent studies that Multnomah County used to have that involved blood tests and drug analysis of people coming into the jail system. That is voluntary, and it's not used for prosecution, but it makes a good, it pretty much tells you what the climate is for the various drugs, because it's the ones that are actually in people's system as they, as they're incarcerated. Right? We had a discussion this morning in human services. And I don't know how much emphasis we need to put on meth as a separate form of treatment or a separate characteristics. I think it still gets down to addiction is addiction is addiction. And if we can get people into treatment, there may be some different things that make it more difficult for people, for meth users, but I bet if it was really analyzed, it would be more based on education, the amount of time they've been using, when they started using, that there might be some different characteristics, because this epidemic may be reaching a different group of people, mm-hmm. and that may cause some problems in their treatment needs. Addiction is still addiction.
Judge Larson, did you have more to your presentation? I didn't want to cut you off.
Only one further thing, and I may have to ask Nancy Miller about this because the time is suddenly out of my head, but I would invite anyone who's in this room or the legislature to attend a drug court, an actual drug court in action on Friday of this week. Friday of this weekend, is it 9 or 10? I think it's at 9.
I think it's at 9, too, but I can get the committee the information.
And I think it's in room 50, hearing room 50. There will actually be a graduation of a couple of people from Marion County's drug court, and then some status hearing, a few status hearings of people. And I'm going to provide a couple of people who've been through our drug court program for people to talk to and to make very short remarks to have them give people an idea of why those of us who are doing this feel so so strongly about this ought to be the direction we move as a public, because it gets us results, and it gets them much more consistently than anything else we're doing.
Madam Chair, just a quick clarification on Policy Package 102 that Judge Larson is talking about. There are a number of drug court coordinators in that policy package who are currently funded by federal funds that will be drying up. So, again, we'll be losing those resources if the policy package is not funded.
Well, Judge Larson, I would say that you are and equal to the late Judge Roosevelt Robinson, who was certainly a champion for drug courts.
No one can replace Roosevelt, that's for sure.
You certainly have his fervor. And it's, can't talk about drug courts without thinking about Judge Robinson, can we?
We can't.
And all that he contributed to our getting here. I want to ask you a related question. Do you have any experience with or an opinion about mental health courts?
I oversee two forms of mental health court in Lane County. One is called mental health court. The other is a program we called COD, which was something that was developed in conjunction with the jail. It was a cooperative program where they're looking at people as they come through the door who have been determined from information that's available to them to have a very serious mental health disorder, usually schizophrenics, severe bipolars, and a number of other categories, who also have drug and alcohol problems. The way we set that up is that they would identify them, then they would talk to the prosecutor's office about whether they could be opted into the drug court program, essentially, but under a category called co-occurring disorders, or what we refer to as COD. Then I would actually supervise those people just like I do pretty much in drug court, but my focus would be a little bit different. I'd be looking at their medication history. Are they taking their medications? Are they having problems with those? And I'm sort of basically a resource for them, almost like an ombudsman in a sense, to help them not only through the criminal justice process, but to try to keep looking at their mental health concerns to make sure those are being addressed in a way that person and we generally get a good outcome. Most of the time, actually I could say that after 5 years of doing that, I only had two people in our COD court program that I actually ended up sentencing to the penitentiary, not just because they committed new Measure 11 offenses, but really most of the rest of them actually had better outcomes, amazingly, than the run-of-the-mill meth population that we were dealing with in drug court. There are very successful ways to deal with these offenders, and it does, again, make sense both in terms of the human aspects and processing the cases, but also in terms of public outcomes.
And Madam Chair, Judge Stephen Ticton from Deschutes County will be here tomorrow, and he's going to be talking about the mental health court that Judge Brady started in Deschutes.
Very good.
We've also been working very closely with the client group at DHS who are involved in the mental health system, and Leola McKenzie from my staff has been attending that group on the Chief Justice's behalf, and we've been providing the group with information about the mental health courts, getting their feedback about any issues that we may need to be looking at. And the Chief recently wrote a letter to the group that we could provide to the committee to kind of give you an update on where we are and what we're hearing from the client population.
Very good. Thank you. I look forward to that presentation. And again, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, we have two options at this point. Judge Brewer and I are prepared to do the first part of what we were going to do tomorrow. It's response to another question in the instructions about cost-saving mechanisms that we've put in place, or since the representatives were able to join us, if there are any questions that you have about kind of the technical pieces that we went through while you were gone, we can answer those, whatever the chair prefers.
What I would like to do at this point is just go ahead and adjourn for the day, and we're going to look forward to getting back into a presentation with you tomorrow. Before I do go to the gavel, I'll check in with my colleagues to see if you have any questions or comments. Okay, we will pick this up again tomorrow.
And Madam Chair, Kingsley just reminded me, how remiss of me, that I did not mention Policy Package 106, which has an other funded piece of FTE for increased caseload for the Citizen Review Board reviews. The program nearest and dearest to my heart, my firstborn program, that's in 106.
The anticipated workload impacts.
Correct.
Okay.
I apologize.
Okay, thank you. We are adjourned.